just before we came on the air here, and something I've been looking at this morning, Gary found a headline that said, in fact, there was a political earthquake going on in Ukraine right now inside Kiev, where Andriy Yermak has resigned. And this is just a deepening and a significant, very significant corruption scandal at the highest levels, where his offices were investigated. They sent their version of kind of like an FBI team to go and investigate him. He's the right hand man of Zelensky, and that's on top of basically his left hand man, Mindich, I think his name was, that fled the country. And this thing is going bigger and bigger. And Larry, I mean, this seems pretty soon that they're going to not be able to avoid going to the head, which is Zelensky. What do you see of this?
Yeah. No, the end game is upon us. You remember Yermak was basically a film producer, and he was described as Zelensky's agent, when he was a comedian, an actor. But
go wrong with having that guy call your national policy in war making? I mean, how could it be a surprise?
Yeah. Wow. He went to, when you're battling within the movie and television industry, I guess that could be described as warlike. So that was his background. You know, look, the corruption, if they think that Yermak was the only one that he was corrupt and Zelensky had no idea this was going on. All right. Let's see how that plays.
And you know, Larry, remind me, because I want to say it was the last time we had you on the show here when we were talking about the Mindich part. At that point, $100 million was allegedly, diverted from the energy, et cetera. And you made a comment there that there's actually a $48 billion investigation going on elsewhere. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, this came about. There were some Ukrainian whistleblowers that approached my business partner, former business partner. We're not really active right now. And then John took it as a whistleblower complaint to the Department of Defense, to the Inspector General. And they've now, the Inspector General at what we used to call Department of Defense, now Department of War, opened a criminal investigation. And that investigation has been very active, because it's not allegations. They've actually got evidence. You've got documentary evidence that billions of dollars, up to $48 billion, diverted from USAID out of $360 billion over the last almost 4 years. The money went into banks in Estonia, Latvia, up in the Baltics, and then in which you wonder why Kaja Kallas of Estonia thinks it's so essential to keep this war going, because that money keeps rolling through. Anyway, a lot of that money was diverted and wound up in banks in the Caribbean, like Cayman Islands, that kind of place. And there were payments made to at least 23 members of the U.S. Congress, both members of the House of Representatives and Senate. And so all I got to do is just sit down and make a list. Who are the most vocal senators and congressmen regarding the war in Ukraine? And guarantee you, they're on the list of people getting paid.
So then, if this is what it appears to be, and I was communicating earlier today with somebody who has direct ties to the administration in Kiev, and they say that this is having an earthquake type reaction among the people in Ukraine, because now then it's like, this is not so much, well, this isn't any of the, Russia making allegations or even some in the West making allegations. This is internal investigations by their own NABU and some other organs right there. And they're concerned that this could literally bring the whole regime down. How do you see it?
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that. During my last trip to Moscow, I met with a former Ukrainian prosecutor and with the former prime minister, Azarov, of Ukraine, who left office in 2014 after the Maidan. And they were both saying that, this corruption is deep. It's endemic. It's tied into the oligarchs who've been, using this as another way for them to make money. And so this right now is Zelensky doesn't have a lot of allies to fall back on. He's actually relying upon Europe to try to save his bacon. So this is this is coming to a head, and people who think that he's going to survive this political crisis and he'll be around for another 2 years, No, that's not going to happen.
There's also simultaneously with this, and right now we're only left to speculate and guess based on the foggy evidence that we have. But there is some consideration that this could be, from the Western side, an attempt to make sure this stuff gets public so that we can maybe potentially later say, oh my gosh, who knew that this was happening? My gosh, we have to replace this guy. We can't go on. Meaning, or with the implication being that we want this war to come to an end. And we probably means the United States, because it certainly doesn't mean Brussels. And so we're like, all right, we're going to expose these guys, and now you're not going to have a choice. What do you make of that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. That in fact, the initial leak about the 100 million, because, you know, 100 million when you're talking, you know, almost $50 billion. Yeah, you know, that's pocket change. It's not a lot of money in the overall scheme of things. But that was deliberately leaked out, I believe, in order to put pressure on the Zelensky regime and to start setting up the narrative to justify, yeah, we got to walk away from this because these are a bunch of very corrupt people. And they've been stealing U.S. taxpayer dollars.
And apparently that if that was the case, and to me, that makes sense. That's what I think they could have done months ago.
Yeah.
The administration probably should have. I know many people were actually saying it on some of these Ukrainian Telegram channels. They were worried about that almost from the time Trump came in office, especially after that February debacle in the Oval Office. A lot of people were afraid it might happen then. It didn't. And history will tell us whether it happened now or this genuinely was something domestic, et cetera. But if it was the other, with the West actually doing this on purpose, apparently that memo hasn't gotten to everybody.
You are.
Because two things. First, and we'll show this later on our channel, I had a debate this morning with General Ben Hodges on Mario Nafal. That went interesting. I'll talk about that a little bit more later.
Oh, really?
But the other thing here is that Michael McFaul is still saying, hey, listen, all this stuff about Russia winning, no.
Well, the Russian army's tired too. I think we need to remember that. The Russian army is losing casualties at a far greater rate than the Ukrainian army is. And after 3.5 years of fighting, they've barely moved on the battlefield. I mean, you look at a map, it's basically the same map with very incremental villages here and there being lost after 3.5 years. So the idea that the Russians are winning, that is an idea sometimes floated here in the United States. It's just not true. It is tragic, however, that both sides are losing too many people. And that's why, of course, we would like to see an end to this war. But it is incorrect to assume that Ukraine is on the verge of collapse. I just see no evidence to support that proposition.
Man, I see no evidence. No evidence, Larry Johnson. Do you?
Well, if Russia's losing, man, why are we pushing a peace plan? I mean, if Ukraine is actually winning and Russia's on the ropes, I mean, the economy's going to collapse any minute. The army's barely hanging on. Hey, man, keep pushing forward.
Really good
We're
point.
Winning. But that's not what they're saying. The West is desperate to figure out how to stop the Russians. And McFaul is just so fundamentally dishonest. They love to use this, they've only taken X percentage of Ukraine, where they take the entirety of Ukraine, including all the land that's to the west of the Dnieper River, and they can put that in the calculation. Well, Russia's not trying to take land west of the Dnieper River. So let's go back and look at what's happened east of the Dnieper River. Well, you've had a number of critical centers fall in the previous years. Mariupol was the first one in May of 2021, then Bakhmut in 2023, and then Avdiivka in 2024.
Lysychansk, Severodonetsk before that. Yeah, just add that to the list.
But now we've had Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Kramatorsk, they're in Lyman. I mean, it's just, it's now piling up, and it's moving very, very rapidly now. And a couple of reasons. The primary reason that Russia has moved slowly over the past 2 years is they didn't have their manpower up, you know, the ground forces they needed to be able to launch attacks along eight axes of operations weren't there because they had mobilized, they were recruiting. These recruits go through training, and so they were they were building up gradually. They weren't under any pressure. There wasn't like there was a gun to their head or a ticking time bomb. You got to get this done in the next 3 months or else. They were just moving, yeah, building the pressure. And now what we're seeing is the culmination of they've got over 750,000 troops there in Ukraine carrying out these operations. And the Ukrainians, they don't have the manpower anymore. They're struggling to figure out that they're trying to stop in one area. And when they divert troops to that area, then the Russians just push farther and faster. It's like they've covered like 400 kilometers, square kilometers already down in Zaporizhia. And, if you're the Ukrainian general staff, you're trying to figure out where the Russians going to hit us next, because Russia now has, they've got a freedom of movement. But I find it fascinating also that McFaul and these guys, they want to criticize Russia's military operations, whereas Russia is actually moving forward and failed to acknowledge the failures, obvious failures of the United States going back to Vietnam and in Iraq and Afghanistan. We got this mighty army, supposedly, and yet we were unable to contain and calm the situation in Afghanistan.
And let me ask you one of the questions I was asked earlier today, and I'll tell you how I responded afterwards. Let's see what your reply would have been. And Mario Nafal asked me, he says, okay, well, what do you say about the charge that General Hodges had just made that, well, not only has it only been this 1 inch, or this 1% over this, whatever it is, last two years or something like that. It's just minuscule number, which you cited a second ago. But then he said, also, the fact is that the Russians, they just can't go any farther because that's all they can do. And so all the Ukraine side has to do is hold on. What do you say to that?
Well, number one, this is carried out as a special military operation, which means they have not mobilized their society. When you go back and look at when Russia went into Ukraine in February of 2024, they went in with only 125,000 troops up against a force of about 300,000 on the part of Ukraine. And the purpose was to create pressure for negotiations. That worked. The negotiations were taking place in March. They'd actually reached tentative agreements. Then the West basically told Ukraine, no, you can't make this agreement. And then they launched Ukraine. The Ukrainian decision was to mobilize 900,000 of their reservists and to start fighting Russia. Russia was slow to react, and this is where you had the advances, particularly up in Kharkiv, where the Russians were forced to fall back, but led to the mobilization of 320,000 in 2022. But at no point did the Russians panic and go, oh my God, we're losing, because they continued to offer contracts. They were recruiting people through contracts, and they were conscripting at a rate of about 30,000 a month, and they were building their force up. But unlike what's taken place in Ukraine, the Russians they put these people through basic training and then advanced individual training, as has been your experience in the military. So these new troops are coming in at a rate of about every 6 months. The number was increasing. The fact that Russia suffered some casualties, but nowhere near what the Ukrainians did, simply from a standpoint of mathematics. The Russians had like an 8 to 10 to 1 advantage with artillery. And then the Russians had a complete advantage with respect to aerial bombs and missiles and rockets. And so just from a firepower standpoint, completely disproportionate. So
And one of the corollary questions that was asked, tagging right along with that, the one that I had the biggest reaction to, was he said, and oh, by the way, Russia, this big, scary power, and yet in nearly 4 years, they haven't been able to defeat this one little country all by itself. And so what does that tell you about the Russian power?
Well, because Russia's fighting NATO. So Ukraine is not by itself. This project to build up Ukraine started in 1995 when NATO made the base Yavoriv in western Ukraine a de facto NATO base. And from that, and then you go back to 2015 with the Battle of Debaltseve, where Ukrainian army was on the verge of getting surrounded, you know, a Custer's last stand sort of situation. And the West intervened with Merkel and Hollande of France to get the Minsk II agreement. And as they later, as they admitted, both admitted in December of 2022, that the entire purpose of that Minsk II agreement was to buy Ukraine time so they could build up the army. So here is Ukraine with NATO trainers, NATO generals, and primarily U.S. generals doing the military planning for their activities, providing the weapon systems, providing intelligence, all the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance data. So here's Russia fighting basically a NATO-backed army, a peer army. And compare that with the United States, who were fighting Mujahideen in Afghanistan, goat herders wearing sandals and carrying Kalashnikovs, who were not backed by any foreign power, who didn't have artillery, who didn't have tanks, who didn't have fixed-wing aircraft, who didn't have helicopters, who didn't have long-range cruise missiles. And they fought us to a standstill. So Russia seems to be doing pretty damn good against Ukraine and NATO, which is why NATO now has emptied its warehouses of HIMARS, ATACMS, artillery rounds. So, you know, you can couch it any way you want, Mario. But
That was General Hodges. Mario just asked the question. Oh, it was Hodges that was jumping on there. Surprise that is, right?
Yeah.
That's mostly what I said, but you added more to it than that. So your answer would have been better. So good on you.
I'm not sure. Well, I got forewarning. You got hit with a cold.
let's go back to what Putin said here, because I want to take a look at that. There were several things he said in that conference that he had that we mentioned before, and then one other one on top of that, which I think is really instructive into where this thing could be going next. First of all, let's look at the Europeans, because represented by General Hodges and McFaul here and a number of others, Jack Keane, a number of those guys and a bunch more in the Great Britain. They want to continue this war almost without any question or any hesitation. And Putin answered this question here, because he was asked, if this war continues on, what is that going to mean? And he looked to the Europeans, he's like, it seems like they still want to fight to the last Ukrainian.
They'll lose their most combat-ready units, as is currently happening near Krasnomorsk. And they're saying, enough, preserve the core of the armed forces and your statehood. This is what we need to think about, say those who hold this view. Others, who believe that Kupiansk has already returned to the control of the Ukrainian armed forces, insist on continuing the fighting until the last Ukrainian. That's the difference in approaches. And who is attacking Mr. Witkoff? These are the representatives of the other point of view, who want to steal money together with the Ukrainian establishment and continue the fighting until the last Ukrainian. But I have already said publicly that, in principle, we are ready for this.
So it just as a reminder, when he's talking about who's attacking Witkoff, there's been a lot of people in the West that has attacked Witkoff and this whole idea that we're trying to find a negotiated settlement, because they say, oh, it's just a capitulation to Russia. This was, in fact, these 28 points were authored by Russia, et cetera. And it's the people who don't want a solution to this, who don't want this war to come to an end. So they want to sabotage America's position, Trump's position specifically, so that they can fight. And it sounds like, and you look at that first soundbite we opened up with Putin, they're willing to fight this out until, if it goes to the last Ukrainian, it's like, so be it.
Yeah. Yeah. See, these critics in the West just simply don't understand the strong position Russia is in right now. Because down in Kherson and Zaporizhia, this is at the lower end of the Dnieper River basin. And Ukraine relies at least 60% of its economy depends upon river traffic going down to the Black Sea so that they can export grain and other minerals that previously they were shipping out. So once Russia completes its stranglehold, and they will occupy at least the east bank of the Dnieper River, the traffic will be cut off. So, I mean, the Ukraine's economy will be dead. And the, in fact, that's is probably where it is right now, to be honest. So the Russians, the general staff has a plan. You know, they never panicked. Did they make some bad decisions at some point or maybe underestimate the threat? I think, yeah, that you could probably make that case. But they recovered pretty quickly, and you don't sense the panic on their side like we're seeing visibly in the West. Because if the West, you know, the Western narrative is Russia's losing, Russia's on the ropes, and Ukraine is strong, it's winning, then why all the urgency about, oh, we got to get Russia to the table to make an agreement? Well, why? I mean, if Russia's really all, you're beating them, finish beating them. You know, don't throw in the towel, knock them out. But they can't knock them out because the actual numbers on the ground tell a completely different story. Minimum of 40,000 killed or wounded every month by the on the Ukrainian side. An additional 20 to 40,000 deserting. So anywhere from 60 to 80,000 a month out the door. And they're only bringing in through the door 17,000 and maybe up to 20,000. So they're having a net loss of anywhere between 40 to 60,000 soldiers a month. It's unsustainable.
Yeah, you can't bleed that out and sustain just the functionality of the armed forces for much longer. I want to ask you a really interesting question here, something I've been pondering here the last couple of days. I'm stuck here in Washington, D.C., just reading news reports, looking at the frontline maps and the various sources, Russian, Ukrainian, European, and Russia and American, et cetera, and just kind of piecing together what the reality of it is. You have two narratives being told by the leaders at the highest levels on both sides, which are mutually exclusive. Only one of them can be true. They can't both be true. Let's look, first of all, at the Western European side, especially at NATO side. You had, I believe it was the day before Thanksgiving, where Mark Rutte came out and said, there's basically not going to be a negotiated settlement. We're not going to go down that path. And he said, and by the way, even after this thing is done, there still isn't going to be peace with Russia. We are still set up for long-term conflict. So he's saying it doesn't matter if you get a negotiated settlement or not. This war is not going to come to an end in one form or another from the West to the East. So they're continuing to go down this path. Then simultaneously on this side, you have now Vladimir Putin putting his credibility on the line and saying, look, you want to fight to the last Ukrainian? I don't really want to, but we will do it. We'll either get it this way or that way. That's the ultimatum. Yeah. You can't have both of those things being true. If we're as good as we say, and if Ukraine can hang on like we claim, then Mark Rutte's point can't be true. They can't hold on, so they're going to lose. Now, I guess the second part could be true. They're going to continue on with a new Cold War type situation with Russia. Right. But would, from this side, it's hard for me to categorically say that one or the other is not accurate. But my worry is that if truth proves him to be inaccurate, then he would lose a lot of credibility. But I think it might be worse. And this is why I'm asking you, because you've got more access to the Russian side and experience than I do. If Putin makes that claim and he can't back it up, what is that going to do to him in the future? Or is he like the Western politicians, will just say whatever and explain it away later?
Yeah, he's anything but like a Western politician. And let's step back and look at the Rutte claim. One of the interesting points that was in this 28-point peace plan, or the outline, the framework for discussion, is that the Europeans insisted, oh, Ukraine's got to be allowed to have an 800,000-man army. So we go back and look that in February of 2022, the size of the Ukrainian army then was about 300,000 active duty, another 900,000 in reserve. And so what the Europeans are now saying is, oh, no, we've got to have an 800,000-man Ukrainian army. And so I stood back and said, well, geez, what's the size of the British army and the French army and the German army? Do you know that the combined size of those three major NATO members is just shy of 500,000. So basically what they're saying is they want Ukraine to have the what would then be the second largest army in NATO. Number one would be the United States. Currently, Turkey is in there with 300,000. But no, we want Ukraine to have 800,000. Now, so this comes back to NATO has no strength. That NATO does not have the combat power to do this. Meanwhile, Putin hasn't even turned on the mobilization engine because Russia, according to not my opinion, but Stanislav Karpivnik, who's been on your show, Stas says that look, we've got 10 million reservists. Now, Western numbers say 3 million. No, it can't be 10 million. I don't believe Stas, in my experience with him, is one to exaggerate or lie about things like that. He takes the military issue very, very seriously. Russia can mobilize 10 million if they decide to, but they haven't decided to because they don't.
3 million is going to be decisive if you can even do that. So, yeah. I mean, even the lower end of that is decisive.
Yeah, but they haven't needed to.
Yeah.
Because they're winning. The casualties on the side of the Ukrainian are piling up. And, what we're witnessing is all these sort of frantic diplomatic measures, both by Europeans and by the Trump administration. And remember, the Trump administration, after Anchorage, sort of walked away, said, well, there was no urgency. And we come back and say, why a sudden, hey, but let's get this peace plan going. It's the same thing that happened in January of 2015 with the Battle of Debaltseve, when the Ukrainian army was threatened with extinction. And the West intervened, and they convinced Putin, and he's admitted he made a mistake in getting bamboozled by the likes of Merkel and Hollande, the then president of France. And he said, okay, they agreed to Minsk too. And it wasn't an agreement between Putin and the West. That was an agreement between the government of Ukraine and the Donbass leaders in both Luhansk and Donetsk. That was who the agreement was with. The Russians and the French and the Germans, everyone were like the guarantors of it. And with Lukashenko up in Belarus, fell apart, but as was later admitted, that was all a ploy just to buy time to rebuild Ukraine. That's what they're trying to get right now. They're trying to get Russia to stop because Russia's destroying the Ukrainian army and, by extension, destroying NATO. But here's NATO saying, oh, yeah, we're never going to give up. What are you going to come to the table with? You can't, if they were serious, they would start mobilizing their armies in Germany, France, and the UK. But they're not because they don't have the money. And they don't have the industrial base.
And I would add also, because they don't believe that Russia is going to come after them. And that is an important part. That's also an element of what we're talking about here, yeah, which Putin also addressed today, because this claim continues to be, which General Hodges said to me this afternoon, but nearly any day you want to read it, you can look at Ursula von der Leyen, Keir Starmer et al. I mean, all of them, they keep saying, Russia's coming after us next. We have to get ready. Putin addressed that.
They publicly tell their population, their citizens, that Russia is preparing to attack Europe and that we need to immediately strengthen our defense potential. Either they're serving the interests of the defense industry and private companies, or they're trying to boost their domestic political approval ratings against this backdrop, given the dire state of the economy and social sphere. But from our point of view, it's complete nonsense, an outright lie.
Okay, yeah. So you would expect that if Putin actually had a plan to invade, that's exactly what he would say. Oh, that's ridiculous. It's not a lie. Why should we believe him?
When was the last time that Russia, quote, invaded Europe? 211 years ago, 1814, where the Russians, along with a bunch of angry Germans and Austrians, marched their way to Paris in retaliation for Napoleon having come to Moscow in 1812. So, but Russia didn't invade Europe during World War II, the Great Patriotic War. Russia fought back after being invaded, not just by Germans, but by Romanians and Hungarians and Italians and Spaniards who helped Hitler invade Russia, the then Soviet Union. So at the end of the war, when Soviet forces were advancing into Europe, they were attacking Germans and German-backed armies that had attacked them. And then, you know, at the end of World War II, yeah, they set up a buffer zone. Now, we in the West, see, they're in world domination. Well, I'd suggest that if we were in the same position the Soviets were, we would have done the same thing. They put in place a buffer zone to control. They didn't go out to conquer the world. That's been the Western lie, the Western mythology, because as long as we got those Russians as an enemy, that Defense Department's going to keep rolling along. Roll them, roll them, roll them. Keep that money flowing. You know, yeah. It's here in Russia. You know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had Yeltsin, who was a bit of a drunkard, say, "Hey, can we like join NATO?" And we were like, "No, you can't. No, no, we can't have that." The same with Bill Clinton. Putin made the request. No, with George W. Bush, Putin made the request. No, 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 because once we do that, how do we justify what was then a $600 billion defense budget, which is now a $1 trillion defense budget? Because we got to have that external enemy.
You got to have an enemy. Yeah.
Yeah. So this,
I mean, you know, China could be it, but I mean, we got to pick one. So I guess we'd just pick Russia for now. We'll switch over later if that helps out. But
yeah,
as long as we have an enemy to justify that. You know, everybody in the West is not on board with this. And I think that you could say that Hungary and the United States, at least ostensibly, actually are breaking from the rest of European NATO in that they're actually seeking an end to this. And as it turns out, Viktor Orban was back in Moscow today. And as you know, he was in Washington, D.C. to talk to Putin, to talk to Trump just a couple of weeks ago. And in that statement, he said, you know, Ukraine cannot win this war. It's as simple as that. It's self-evident that we can't. Let's find a negotiated settlement. So he went now back to Moscow again today to talk about that. And in his response to Orban, President Putin still insists that they're willing and interested in diplomacy with the United States and Hungary.
Thank you for responding in such a way, for providing a platform, for providing a location to arrange a summit between myself and the president of the U.S. Donald was the one who suggested this. He immediately said that we maintain good relations with Hungary. And you have good relations with Viktor, and I have good relations with Viktor. And of course, we were delighted to agree to this.
So what do you make of that from the Russian perspective? Is this just trying to divide NATO, which certainly it does have an element of that? Are they actually trying to get to a negotiated settlement, or is this just a ruse while they continue to roll to the West?
Well, what's interesting is to look at who the three people that were sitting there on the side with Putin. The first guy is Ushakov. I think the second guy is Medvedinsky, who's been the lead negotiator in talks, the last talks with the Ukrainians in Istanbul. And then that fellow at the very end, that's my buddy Sergei Lavrov. So, and yes, in the press conference that Putin held at Bishkek, was it on Tuesday or Wednesday? He made the point. He was asked, you know, who's your lead negotiators? Those three right there. That's who he identified as the lead negotiators for Russia with all things concerning peace with Ukraine. So, you know, I think he's showing Orban a genuine say, look, yeah, we're serious about this. We would love to get a negotiated settlement, but we have laid out what our terms are. And we're not going to back off of those. We're not in a situation where we need to back off of those. And so we would like to secure peace through diplomacy. But if we don't do that, we're going to do it militarily. And he also has said in the course of this year that the territory that the Russian soldiers occupy in places like Dnipropetrovsk is currently not part of the Russian Republic. Neither is Kharkiv. Neither is Sumy, neither is Poltava, neither is Odessa. But he's made the point, if we start taking, if we've got soldiers in those territories, then you know what? Those territories will have an opportunity to vote whether or not they want to become part of Russia. And if they vote to become part of Russia, hello, we've got four or five new republics. So this, you know, the Russians... are not on a clock. You know, this is not like the final 2 minutes.
So let me ask you, do you think that at this point, and you've mentioned the issues with the Debaltseve battle and then the resulting Minsk agreements that require Russia to have basically a ceasefire there, which they agreed to, which to their remiss now, everything that happened in Istanbul in 2022, what didn't happen in June 2024, and the resistance now, does Russia actually think that there is a possibility that they could get a diplomatic solution that the West would agree to?
I don't think so, but they're not going to. They want to show themselves as being open to that, that they're willing to have a negotiated settlement. But I think they're also sensible enough to recognize there's no way that the West, you know, because you got to step back and look. This is not just a conflict that's going on in Ukraine. When you look at CIA and MI6 operations in places like Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, this is part of a broader Western covert action to try to destroy Russia. So it's not like this conflict with Ukraine is just an isolated event. This is part of a much broader strategy. The West is fighting for its economics, fighting to survive as the leading power in the world, and it's losing. It's losing that on every front, particularly on the economic front. And so this war is just another proxy by way of trying to destroy and conquer Russia. And I think the Russians understand that. I know that I did have I spent 3 days with Sergei Karaganov, who has been the leading voice in Russia for saying, hey, we need to forget about the West. We need to look east. The future of Russia is in the east with China and Siberia. That's where our economic future is. The Europeans, they're history.
And I guess if you're looking at everything combined, I mean, we showed you there yesterday where President Putin was sitting there saying, yeah, we're still willing to negotiate, but we'll get it one way or the other. About a week or 10 days ago, in a little bit different environment, wearing a military uniform, he said this.
What the political leadership of Ukraine is, we already understand. Yes, since March of last year, it is no longer any kind of political leadership. It is a group of individuals, a criminal gang, an organized criminal community that, since March of last year, has usurped power and, under the pretext of the need to continue the war with Russia, is holding on to this power in Ukraine for the purpose of personal enrichment. But we have our own tasks, our own goals. The main one is the unconditional achievement of the objectives of the special military operation and the fulfillment of the tasks that our fatherland and the people of Russia set before us. The people of Russia are counting on us, counting on you, and expecting the result the country needs.
Two critical things from there to me in my mind. One is that he said he's calling for the unconditional accomplishment of the objectives of the special military operation as he sees it, unconditional. So that means no variations from the June 2024. And then the first part of that was the literal demonization of the Ukrainian regime, i.e., there is no negotiating partner. So reading the tea leaves.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, all we got to do is listen to what he says. He's not one of these Western politicians who lies. Well, you know, who'll say anything in order to placate the public. He's been they've been consistent. Not just him. Peskov has said it. Lavrov has said it. Sergei Rybakov, the deputy foreign minister, he said it just this week as well. They're not kidding. You know, they'd like to have this settled, but they had tried for the last 30 years, going back to 1995, to have a working relationship, to have a conflictual relationship with NATO and the West. They wanted to be partners with us, not enemies. And God, I still hear some people in the West talk about Russia's a communist country. No, they're not. They've got, in fact, the Communist Party only holds about 5% of the seats in their national legislature. Putin's party has got like 90%, and the commies got 5%, and then these other smaller parties make up the rest. They're anything but communist. They're an Orthodox Christian country. That is what they are. But, you know, again, we refuse to accept them and to listen to them. Just listen. You know, when they keep telling you over and over and over and over, you know, we're not going to surrender. We're not going to accept a ceasefire. We're not going to give back this territory. We want NATO to get the hell out and leave us alone. I mean, that's one message I heard very consistently. It's like, leave us alone. We can live without you. We don't need you.
Yeah, and that message is not being received. I mean, this again, the debate I just had earlier today, and everything that we keep seeing from the Western side is that they will not accept that. I just don't see any possibility of this being resolved anyway, except for the force of arms, and that's only going to favor one side there. Listen, in the remaining amount of time that we have here, speaking of the resolution of this, let's look back to something that Putin mentioned earlier in this about the corruption in that last soundbite there. That was on the 22nd of November. He was talking about the corruption of the Ukraine government. Well, now then we have right there in your face that it's even at the highest levels of Zelensky's inner circle here. How do you see this transpiring? We've talked a lot about where the military front's going, but this is now shaking the foundations of the Ukrainian very seat of government. Right. How do you see this playing out, let's say, over the next month and a half?
Self-preservation is going to kick in, and Yermak's going to say, you're going to make me the fall guy? No. He's going to start spilling, who his collaborators were, who his enablers were. And I guarantee you, names like Boris Johnson are going to pop up. There are Western politicians, people in NATO, that are going to be fingered for having taken millions of dollars and profited off of this, for facilitating it. Yeah, Yermak's not going to be the fall guy. Yeah, and the only way they would have prevented this, they would have killed him. Now, if he winds up dead in the next day or two, he committed suicide. He shot himself in the back of the head 4 times. You know, he was serious about doing it. But if he winds up dead, then yeah, they may have a way to try to save Zelensky. But now, if you're when so, you're so
let's, let's, let's look at the ramifications of that internally. There's already a lot of problem with the Ukraine military being frustrated at their military command and at Zelensky's specific military decisions that he's made in so many disastrous places like the Kursk, like Krynky, like staying in Bakhmut too long and staying in Mirnograd, not allowing them to extract themselves when they had the chance. So now then, if you add this to it, what do you think this might do to the coherence of the Ukrainian armed forces and their willingness to keep dying in large numbers for this regime?
No, it's going to accelerate the desertion rate. And in fact, I think it wasn't Doug McGregor on your show the other day that he mentioned that he had actually picked up some information that there are certain commanders out, getting savaged by the Russians that are talking about turning and marching on Kiev.
No, I didn't. That wasn't on our show. That's news to me.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe he was with Judge Napolitano, but he said, that's what he's heard. And if that's true, again, it's just one further sign that, the rats are leaving the sinking ship. This Ukrainian project is taken on water. It's hit the iceberg. It's sinking, and there's no way to keep it afloat. And so we're now at the everybody ahead for the lifeboats, and we don't have enough lifeboats phase.
It is a Titanic moment, and I think it's going to be as calamitous as that one was, just on a much bigger scale. And then we're going to, we don't have time to get into it here, but hopefully the next time you're on, then we'll get into what's going to happen with NATO. Because if everything collapses, Russia does attain a military victory, and we never did the diplomacy part, we're going to have to be left with the fallout and the wreckage. And things are going to get ugly. And unfortunately, we could make some even worse decisions about how to engage with Russia after that. And that's the big worry going forward.
Yeah, fully agree.
Yeah. Listen, in the meantime, though, it's terrific episode today. Really appreciate these great insights that you've had here on this breaking news that we've had here in a couple of different fronts. And look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you, brother. Always appreciate it.
Always my pleasure to have you on, too. And just a reminder to you folks, we are on podcast. I know a lot of you actually like your information, or your friends do, to get a podcast so you can listen as you're driving to work or whatever, or you just like it that way. Let them know. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You'll find us there. We're also on the written form at DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. And then, of course, we have these videos here. And follow our ex, too. We always are on that. But we, whatever you need, we got it. Make sure you share this, folks. Don't keep all this great information yourself. I promise you, you're not getting this kind of information on mainstream legacy media. Don't keep this to yourself. Make sure others get the truth, because we are unintimidated and uncompromising. We'll continue to be so for your benefit. Thank you very much, folks. And we will look forward to seeing you in about an hour right here. There's one other thing I feel a need to discuss today, because yesterday was Thanksgiving in America, and the president made a point on Truth Social, a post, and ordinarily it's just kind of a perfunctory thing. You know, yay, we're thankful for all this kind of stuff. Trump's was a little bit different than that, in ways that are, in my view, decidedly un-American and not America first. We're going to be talking about what that was. Tune in at, I think, 3 p.m. Yeah, 3 p.m. today, Eastern. We'll be on that for you. Thanks very much, folks, and we'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.